Welcome to Survival Mode Disrupted, the podcast for those who are done performing, done people pleasing, and done living life on autopilot. I'm your host, Leticia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and this is where we create disruptive, unapologetic transformations for those who are ready to exit survival mode and reclaim their power. Every episode is your permission slip to burn the rule book, break the cycle, and finally build a life that feels like yours. So let's disrupt everything that's holding you back and start living life on your own terms. This is your trigger warning. This podcast is raw. It is real, and it doesn't sugarcoat what it means to survive trauma, abuse, mental health battles, or even the aftermath of living in survival mode for too damn long. What you hear on Survival Mode Disrupted includes unfiltered stories, graphic details, and a vulnerable truth that may trigger some of the audience. Please prioritize your emotional safety. If something feels too heavy, pause. Breathe. Come back when you're ready or not at all. Your healing is yours to honor. These episodes are based on lived experience, not therapy sessions or clinical advice. Listening does not replace mental health treatment or constitute a coach-client relationship. If you're in crisis, please seek immediate help from a licensed professional or contact your local emergency services. This space is built with care, but it's also built for truth and built for disruption. Take what you need, leave the rest, and most of all, trust yourself. If this podcast speaks to your soul, you don't have to do this work alone. Feel free to join our free Facebook community for high-achieving women ready to break cycles and heal out loud. Join us at Disrupting Survival Mode on Facebook. Or grab the book that started this movement, Exiting Survival Mode, a raw step-by-step guide to help you identify, release, and rebuild from the survival patterns that have been keeping you stuck. Hello, 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 and welcome back to another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted. I am your host, Leticia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and today we have Dawn Marie with us. Dawn Marie, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Dawn Marie Risley-Childs. I'm a board-certified psychiatrist, and I am a survivor and thriver of 24 years of domestic violence, physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, and neglect.
Wow, welcome. We have a lot in common, so I can't wait to hear your story.
Okay.
How would you describe survival mode?
Exhaustion. Always feeling exhausted, but still reaching that metaphorical hand behind the back of your neck and pulling yourself up anyway to get going.
Yes, a friend
of mine had said, a fellow psychiatrist had said, people with PTSD are the most tired people she knows. And I was always feeling tired, no matter how much rest I was able to get.
I can relate to that as well.
Yeah.
So tell us your story to and through survival mode.
Well, so really, I want to talk about the turning point. And my turning point is a bit less of a right angle and more of one of those, you know, I need to make a left turn and I have to turn right into the jug handle to do so, like they have in New Jersey. It was really a growing tired of doing what I was doing and not wanting and wanting to do something else and knowing that there was something more for me. And feeling very weighed down. I ended up getting coaching from another physician, from a retired surgeon, and he was mentioning forgiveness, which I did not want to do. One of the things that my stepfather had demanded of me was forgiveness. And so that seemed like a dirty F word to me, the word forgiveness. And as I was going through coaching, while there were some things that were helping, there was still something very underlying. And one of the things he said was when I explained to him, because I started looking up, why am I so exhausted? And why do I feel tired all the time? And why do I have pains here? And why is this problem happening? And I read The Body Keeps the Score, and it was all laid out for me there about what was going on and was happening because of the trauma, the cortisol levels, et cetera, those things that take effect in a person who has trauma. And we had discussed whether or not I should get what kind of treatment I should get. And I had been interested in ketamine, had considered opening a ketamine clinic, and researched it and made plans to travel to Florida for PTSD treatment with ketamine. And then my mother was coming to visit. And within moments of getting her from the airport, there was the criticism. And she started. I had cleaned my entire house, gotten everything together, hauled out all the decorations, put everything up, did my hair, did my makeup, got my eyebrows done, did whatever I could to take away any ammunition, because visits with my mother felt more like a performance review rather than a visit. And she started with the mud that was on the floor of my car. Well, it's December, it rains, it's Mendocino, it's the North Coast. It gets muddy here. You only have to, it only takes one moment. It takes one drive to get the car muddy. And then the criticisms about my husband. And I was so appalled. And within a few, and then the racist comments start. And I felt the gravitational pull. I was fighting the gravitational pull of my car to turn around and drop her back off at the airport and leave her there. But my kids knew that she was coming. I didn't want to disappoint them for Christmas. And I kept her here. And everything was. My son was in the army. He wasn't in the army, referring to my husband. He's such a know-it-all. Then talking about me, talking about my brothers, all of the negativity, the negative things that you would say to about her neighbors that are her friends. Then she talked about the house. Whenever she talks about the house or that house, it's the house where I was raised. Not just the house where I was raised, but the house where I was beaten, the house where I was threatened, the house where I was raped, the house where I was, molested, constantly exposed, having the voyeurism, the house of hell for me. And she talks about how that house looks like shit. There are no flowers out there. It's not like when I was there and I kept it so nice and I kept it with the flowers. Flowers grow where there's a lot of manure. And that's what that house was for me, was a pile of manure. And I recognized I'm not going to satisfy her. It came to a gift, really two gifts that I had given her. One was this wallet that had matched the purse that I had purchased for her for Mother's Day. And apparently she didn't like it. She bragged about it, how wonderful it was over the telephone when she received it. She's in New Jersey, I'm in California. But the sneer that she gave of this gorgeous Brahmin ombre wallet in all of the colors that she had asked for in a purse several months before. And it took me 3 months to find the matching wallet, because by the time I got around to paying it, money was tight and I was serving, and there was no appreciation of me, no appreciation of the fact that, my house is twice the size of the one that I grew up in. My property is twice the size of the one where I was raised. The cars are multiple times the price of the car that she was driving. It didn't matter what my successes were. Here I am, having taken on all of that abuse and still came out and not only went to medical school, but graduated and became a physician and am helping others heal. None of that mattered. There was still always something that I was not good enough for her. And I recognized I'm never going to satisfy her. And that's what I said in my head as I listened to her spewing out all of this negativity. When I got to the airport, dropped her off at the airport, I asked her, "Mom, did you like the wallet?" "No, not really." "Oh, I'm just teasing. It's fantastic." And I thought, no, she wasn't teasing. And months before, I had given her the option, "If you don't like it, my feelings won't be hurt. Send it back at one you do like." "Yeah, you have to get," they told me, "you could just send it back. The gift certificate is in it, return address is in it. All you have to do is put it in the mail." That's really what started allowing me to heal. I did the ketamine treatment. After about six treatments, I realized, or I recognized, this isn't going to do it for me, and I needed to do something else. And a friend of mine who, when I spoke to, was normally a bit on the bitter side. And he was being far more calm and less anxious. And he had told me that I need to go get some golden teacher. And I said, "Well, what is that?" And he said, "Well, they're magic mushrooms. They help with trauma." And I ended up finding someone who does psychedelic therapy underground, and had and underwent my first session. And I never recognized how angry I really was at my mother. And the first treatment, he gave me some rules. He said, "You're not allowed to hit me, and you're not allowed to hurt yourself, but we're going to go through some anger work, and I want you to give it to her." And as I started, I was yelling, but the yelling just didn't feel natural in that moment. I yell when I'm frustrated, which is a form of anger, but when I'm really angry, I speak very low and I asked a lot of questions. "How could you be so stupid to think that it was normal to take your daughter in, to have him shave her bikini line, not once to show you how, but every single week during swimming season, every single summer, every week in summer, all the way up into and through college? How could you think that this is normal? How could you allow that to happen?" And that was just one of the things and one of the issues that I addressed. But I started going one thing after another with all of the things my mother turned her head to. And my healer said she collaborated with him. Collaborated? Wait a minute. Because I had always painted my mother as the picture of a victim. And what I've come to learn and realize is that she has been painting herself as a victim. And she would antagonize me until I would yell at her to stop setting those blowing through boundaries. And then, "Oh, you're hollering at me." And then painting herself as the victim and then wanting to leave. And And what I came to learn through psychedelic medicine. So psychedelic medicine is autobiographical. So it puts you in the moment of your past, where you've been. So much so that you can feel, there was at one point where I was able to feel the texture of the carpet, of the red carpet in the apartment where we lived when I was five, and go through the moment that she told me about Diggerly dog sex. I know it's a big question mark on your face. It wasn't all at once. Interesting the way memories are stored in the brain. They're stored, long-term memory can be stored in pieces rather than all in one string. So gathering up those memories, it's most likely one of the reasons why, with trauma, when we forget, when patients forget a piece of the trauma, that it's because those pieces are stored in different areas and they can't reach them. And it took about, I kept saying, dig us something. She's saying, dig us something. Dig us something. What is dig a? Dig a? And it kept getting to me. And then all of a sudden, boom, it all strung together. And she said, Diggerly dog sex. She, the time we had a puppy, Gimper, who was a three-legged dog, and which was somewhat of a reflection of the family of, this dog that's broken, or this broken family. And the dog was cleaning himself. And she said, see what the dog's doing? You've got to lick him in the balls. Now I'm in kindergarten when she's saying this. And one of the other times I had, there were times where she was having sex in the bed next to me. We had a two-bedroom apartment. My brothers lived in one room, and she and I lived in the other bedroom. And she kicked me out of bed. Like, I felt her kick me out of bed. I fell onto the floor. I hear what's going on. I crawl around the bed. I'm standing behind this guy who has my mother. And I remembered what she told me. And so I went up to do Diggerly dog sex. And this man had said, what the? And looks back and sees me. And then begins yelling and screaming many profanities and, what is wrong with you? And you're sick, what a sick, just many profanities. And he left the room. And by that time, the light's on, and I'm just sitting there waiting for my mom and her friend to come back so that I can be involved. And I was 5 years old. The sexual abuse started really when I was about four, and it was with my father. My biological father had taken me to, there were motorcycle gangs that were starting up in South Jersey, Philadelphia area. And one of those was the Harpy Warlocks. And he took me to Big John, who was, the big brother, was flanked by children as he's so stereotypical. He's the only one at the campground who has a cabin, and he's standing on the porch and he's throwing candy to kids. And all the kids are all excited. Big John, we love Big John. We're so excited. He gives us candy. And then my father introduces me to him. And from there, he was having me sit on his lap while he was masturbating. Or he was masturbating to me, and I was 4 years old. And those are the things that was the piece that was missing. Was it, well, it wasn't that the piece was missing. I remember bouncing on his knee, but the child in me did not see that and did not understand that. But during one of the trips, of the healing trips, I had been brought back to one of these intense moments where his daughter walked in and he began yelling and screaming at her to get out. And the adult in me saw what was happening. And I was re-traumatized again after that, recognizing that yet again, here I am falling to victim. And there was more. I mean, I'm still uncovering. There's still a few pieces about the baseball field that they're not completely clear, but they're very visual where my brother was trafficking me as well. And my brother was 11, 12, 13 years old at the most. And he was selling me to his friends, letting me have a nickel for every dollar that he makes. And where does an 11, 12, 13-year-old boy learn that? This is before the digital age, before you can go on YouTube, before, highly censored television. And when I look at my children growing up the same age, they are so modest. And my child, they have sexual education in school. And my child is just overwhelmed by it, disgusted by it, disgusted by the whole idea. And so for a young boy to think that of his sister, where does that come from? And I don't think I'm ever going to have the answers to that. But I suspect he was exposed to some type of prostitution somewhere. And maybe that was in our household, but I don't know.
Oh,
You're blown away. Yes, I hear you. I'm going to wait. I'll digest that for a moment. I'm going to take a sip of water. You digest that. You come up with
yeah.
your next question.
I mean, as you were talking, I've had conversations about ketamine and LSD, the psychotherapy as well, the psychedelic therapy. I wrote a note to talk about that. And then the story evolved. So first, I just want to say, and I'm not often moved to say I'm sorry that you experienced that, but I am in this case. And I've heard a lot of stories, and as someone who was molested myself, and I can see how that attention at that particular time created this desire for me to be someone's attention, in someone's attention, right? And it took me a long time to draw those parallels, but it made sense to why my teenagers were very promiscuous. I had a lot of things going on in my home that also added to the desire to be seen by someone. So I guess my question in this moment would be, those experiences that were very sexual at a very young age, how did that shape you as you got older? How did that shape your relationship with man? How did it even shape your relationship with women? Because oftentimes when we have issues with our moms, we struggle with our relationships with women. So I'm just curious as to how did this experience shape you and the environments that you allowed yourself to be in?
A lot of my life is in 3 and 4 year compartments for many years between training, medical school, college, internship, residency, moves, moving from one place to the next. Early on, everything was focused on I need to be able to get out of here, and education is going to be that way. And once I get through medical school, I can leave. And I didn't want to join the military, one, because my stepfather would put roadblocks in my brain for how to support myself, one of which was his description of the military and what that would mean. But I am, while being in the military could have been beneficial financially, there would also be the increased risk of military sexual trauma. One out of three women are sexually traumatized in the military, and 1 out of 10 men in the military are sexually traumatized. And so I would have been just another prime target. Relationships with men had always been very difficult. I didn't have a boyfriend until I was 27. I didn't really date until I was in medical school. And in college, I was just studying all the time. And then my stepfather's abuse continued on until I was 24 and in medical school. And I had gone to a counselor to discuss what had happened to me. I didn't describe in details. I just said, when I was 13, my father snuck in my room and did things that daddies weren't supposed to do. And she was more of a gestalt therapist, and she was pointing to my body language, and I felt judged. And one of the things that I've written in my book and that I talk about is that when you have someone who comes to you and is disclosing, the first thing you need to do is to make sure that that person is safe. And you can start with, do you feel safe with telling me more? Do you feel safe in this room? Do you feel safe on campus? Do you feel safe in your dorm room? Do you feel safe when you go back home to visit? The last one would have been no. Is this still happening? And the answer would have been not the same exact thing, but yes, things continue. And my stepfather had gotten wind of that I had spoken. I had to tell him. He forced me to tell him that I had spoken to a therapist about it. And within, he didn't speak to me. If he spoke to me, it was just about yelling about something that I was doing wrong. And my mother was talking about all the things that I was doing wrong at the house when I came home from my first year of college. And then my stepfather came to me and said, oh, I think I know what our problem is. So my stepfather meets criteria for the Hare psychopathy checklist for psychopathy. It's probably top score is 40. It's score somewhere between 34, 35 to 37-ish. So it's very high in the range. And he took me to a secluded area and he said, he started out like this mania, like, oh, I was so excited. I couldn't wait to tell you when I first thought about it. So and so must have thought I was crazy when I realized it, when it hit me. And I'm thinking, like, I'm waiting with bated breath for him to tell me, like, what is this exciting news? And then he said, you're in love with me. And it was as though I was struck in the gut. What is going to go on now? This man wants to have sex with me. And I was a virgin. And he made sure of that. Dating had so many restrictions on it. And if you spread your legs, you're a slut. And there was all the slut shaming for any kind of sexual desire that I might have, growing into womanhood. Yet my brothers were both encouraged to go have as much sex as possible with as many girls and women as possible. It was the complete opposite. And I had to keep this a secret that I was going through this. And I had spoken to a classmate and to an RA, but I don't think that the RAs are really equipped with dealing with something like this and with, what do they do with this information? And even when I was in medical school, and that's when I finally broke away from him because I was told, hey, for student loans, we can get you another $7,000 if you need. And so I did the math really quickly and said, $7,000, that could last me for the next 6 to 7 months. That pays rent and food, and I'm okay until the next loans come out for school. And it was my housemate that had recognized that there was just something really wrong with this relationship. And he had said to me, Darmarie, is he married? And I said, no, he's not married. Is he hurting you? And I thought, is he punching me? And I said, no. And then he just said, DM, is he married? And I said, no, divorced. And then there was just something inside of me, like, said, okay, like, now's my time to disclose what's going on here. And I said, it's who he was married to is the problem. And he just gave me this pensive look, looked down at the floor, and then, it was as though he was in slow motion where he moved his head slowly and his eyes got wide, and he said, he was married to your mother. And I broke down and said, yes. And he told me, you have to get away from him. Look, you need money. We're talking about all the logistics that he's paid for medical school. What am I supposed to do? And, how am I going to survive? And, I never had my own money. He always took our money away. We would go visit my Aunt Sandy, and we would, she would always shove 50s in our hands. And on the drive home, he would say, did Aunt Sandy give you any money? My brother said, no. Ben, did he give you any money? No. Scott, did Aunt Sandy give you any money? No. Don Marie? Yeah, she gave us each a $50 bill. Hand it over. Pass it up, cough it up. And I finally recognized it wasn't that we were allowed to have money. We were going to visit Aunt Sandy because he wanted 150 bucks and he knew that she would give it to him and he would give us the third degree at the end of the day. That's the psychopathy of the thing. I mean, talk about a strategist. And then my mother's, oh, can't they keep it? No, they know the rules. They know they're not allowed to accept money from anyone. So I grew up learning that I'm not allowed to have money.
It's amazing
And
how some of these stories, what some things create stories for us. I actually just want to cycle back to
yeah.
ketamine versus the psycho. It's lost my
The
mind.
other psychedelics. Well, ketamine
Yeah,
has
the
psychedelic
psychedelic.
properties.
Yes. So
It's
the.
an anesthetic. So ketamine is an anesthetic. But go ahead.
I
I'm sorry. I'm
no worries.
interrupting.
I want to understand the difference for you between ketamine and then the mushrooms. And why do you think the mushrooms help with your healing more?
I've done more than mushrooms.
Okay. You mentioned mushrooms, so that's what I cycle back to.
The ketamine treatment that I was getting was IV, and it made me feel better immediately. The third treatment that I got put me in a loop where that I couldn't get out of, where I saw my mother, I was angry with my mother, I was acutely suicidal. I got a fourth treatment the next day that took me out of that acute agitation, but it gave me tinnitus. And then I did receive two more treatments after that, and it helped my focus and my attention. What I noticed, it helped my anxiety tremendously. I was able to stop ruminating. It was as though someone would cut me off in the morning, and by midnight, I'm still upset about the guy who cut me off, or those minor slights, the everyday slights that we get just by living our lives. And I would be constantly ruminating about them. And the ketamine stopped that. for a while and then would wear off. But I wasn't getting any therapy afterwards. And I think that ketamine is probably best with therapy. It's a very private treatment because you're really just being observed. It's all very internal. And then the things that come up for you are usually discussed in the next session. I think it has its place. I don't think it was for me. The mushrooms really showed me, it brought the visuals back and it allowed me to release the anger that I had feared for so long of releasing. And I think that I held back so much on my successes and in my journey just because if attention got brought to me and this came out, that would be bad attention for my mother. And I feared hurting her or feared destroying her. And now I recognize that my entire life she's been attempting to destroy me from a young age. And it allowed me to be able to say, I'm done with my mother and I'm never speaking with her again. That she is malignant. She is a dangerous person. And I need to protect myself from her and I need to protect my children from her. And God forbid that she did anything to my children. My children always say, no, mom, everything's okay. And so we don't think that anything happened, but you never know. LSD reaches the really deep parts. Those parts that where that anger lives, where that anger is destroying parts of your body. LSD gets to, and it's very in your face. It's confrontational. It puts it right in front of you. And when you relive those moments and you get to be angry and feel the anger for the first time, to really feel the anger, and it releases. And one of the moments in my book, I wrote about terror, and it was a terrorizing trip. And I would never advise anyone to do this alone, ever. Like, don't ever do this kind of thing alone. You want to be with someone who knows these medicines and knows what they're doing with these and with the treatments. But it got down to that terror that I felt of living with my stepfather. And it felt, for days later, it felt as though if you've ever had surgery and had an organ removed, the nerves are still there and they're still a little hot. They don't really hurt, but you're aware that they're there, or you're aware that something is now missing. And that's how it felt. That terror inside of me was just was gone, was removed. And it's extremely healing. I think it can be misused. And so, there's these double-edged swords with these medicines. It has the potential to be misused. But on the healing side, it has brought me to my healing journey by leaps and bounds. And yeah. And I wrote a book. I wrote a book about
So tell us a bit more about the book and
it.
also how we can connect with you online.
Yes, I'll show it to you. Isn't it beautiful? It's
Yes.
called The Offering: A Physician's Journey Through Abuse, Psychedelics, and the Freedom of Forgiveness. It got me to, I'm very proud of it. I love the front. I'm not going to give away the front cover, but the front cover has very special meaning. And it's the three biggest turning points in my life. It starts with the story of that I told you about my housemate confronting me with exactly who this Ron Anderson person was. And it goes through my life of medical school and, up to a bit more towards present day and trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder, psychopathy, antisocial personality disorder. I discuss all those things. And when I got to chapter 10 and I was looking at how it really has affected my life, I reread that chapter and said, oh, this is terrible and uninspiring. And I tore that whole chapter out. I wrote a success chapter because, I wanted to be able to say that I'm doing okay and that despite all that crap that I'm about to take you into from the start, I've lived a pretty good life despite all that. And, between travel, my art collections, skydiving, flying airplanes. Yes, I've jumped out of an airplane 289 times and lived to tell
What?
about it.
I can't even do it once. I can't even think about doing it once.
It's an amazing feeling, and I'd like to get back up in the air again, but not until my children are independent. So when they don't need me anymore, then I'll go jump. My youngest wants to jump with me when she turns 18. Come on, Mom, we'll jump together. She's very excited about it. The other one's like, ah, I'm gonna keep my feet on the ground. He doesn't even like roller coasters. He's not gonna like skydiving. But there are these things that I've done and these places that I've seen, and my life isn't over yet. And I still have so much more that I want to accomplish and I want to do. And I'm still getting up and going to do that. The second part is my early childhood and everything that I remember from at least age six when my stepfather came into our lives and the brutality of it all. And then the third point is really the turning point of the story with my mother coming to visit for Christmas and the healing journey and the things that I uncovered. And there is much more that I uncovered. I'll save it for the readers that they can go pile through. And really about forgiving them. And I was at a place where I called my stepfather and said, I forgive you. I forgive you for it all. And I forgive my brothers and I forgive my mom. And above all, I forgive myself. I forgive myself for carrying the shame. That shame was not mine. I hear things like you were very brave for even putting this down or for even talking about it. There, that's the shame that they still feel ashamed about talking about what happened to them. And that shame is brought on by the perpetrators. The perpetrators force the shame on them. They feel guilty. Oftentimes, women will talk about that it felt good, that they orgasmed when their fathers were raping them. And they feel guilty about that when that's just a natural human response, but they feel betrayed by their bodies and they feel guilt. And I felt tremendous guilt that I was betraying my mother. I always felt guilty about feeling as though I betrayed my mother. And now I'm at the point where I'm thinking maybe my mom was actually in on it the entire time. And not only was she in on it, but maybe she was the maestro conducting the entire orchestra. And I think that. But I've forgiven her too. And now it's time for me to speak and to look at this trauma as a gift. It's a backhanded gift, but it's still a gift. And to use that gift to help others heal and to create something to a way to prevent this from happening to begin with, because no child should ever have to go through the things that I had gone through.
Absolutely. No child. This has been a very interesting conversation. I will get the information about how we can, the audience can get access to your book. But as we
Course.
wrap up the episode, one key takeaway that the audience can action.
You can heal. So many people feel broken and they can heal. They
Absolutely.
can.
Healing is so possible. Dory,
Yes.
thank you so much for your time on
You're
Survival
welcome.
Mode Disrupted and audience. Thank you for catching another episode. I just want to remind you, you were not built to break, but you damn sure were not built to just survive.
Yes.
Disrupt the cycle, reclaim your life, and thrive on your own terms. And I'll see you next week. Once again, thank you for joining another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted, hosted by the Survival Mode Disruptor, Letitia. You didn't land here by accident. This conversation, it probably cracked something open on purpose, because survival mode isn't just a phase, it's a pattern, an identity, a prison masked as strength. But here's the truth: you're not broken. You're just unfinished. So if something stirred in you today, don't ignore it. Don't numb it. Move with it. And I want to once again invite you to join Disrupting Survival Mode, the Facebook community where healing is loud and messy and real. I also want to invite you to buy my book, The Survival Mode Exit Plan, because your breakthrough deserves a blueprint. And if you felt seen today, be sure to share this episode with someone who needs to hear it. Like, subscribe, and drop a review. That's how we amplify the voices that need to be heard. And remember, this isn't about fixing yourself. This is about finding yourself again beneath the rubble. Until next time, choose ease, choose power, choose you. This is Survival Mode Disrupted. Let's keep shaking shit up.